Today is Monday, May 12, 2014. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Legacy Archive, today I am interviewing Bobby Douglas over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Games in Mexico City. Bobby, can you begin with when and where you were born?
I was born in Bel Air, Ohio. In 1942, Bel Air is located on the Ohio River, right off of Route 7, 1 mile from Bridgeport, which is the Cumberland Trail, or Route 40, which is now Interstate 70. My high school was Bridgeport High School, which is located, which at the time was located very near the Ohio River. Since that time, it's moved out to Lansing, Ohio. And Lansing, Ohio is famous for Joe Niekro and Phil Niekro and Johnny Havlicek. And those were the neighborhood kids that I was raised with.
And tell me a little bit about your family.
My family is originally from the Sudan and from Ireland. My great-great-grandmother was Scotch-Irish. She married a African from the Sudan, and they lived in Georgia, and so the genesis of the Davis family, which is part of my family name, the Davis family originated in the swamplands of Georgia, around Albany, Georgia, and we have an old history that goes back through slavery all the way back to Africa.
Wow, that is quite a family history that you've been able to maintain there. So, did you have any siblings?
I was one of seven children. All my siblings died at childbirth or in very young, except for a sister who lived to be 32. I'm the oldest living sibling at 72. I was one of probably seven or eight kids that my mother had. My mother was an invalid. She was injured in a car accident. And my grandfather was a coal miner, and my grandmother was a coal miner's wife. And so we lived in the in what we call the patch, the coal mining patches, which are located throughout eastern Ohio and a lot of the western Pennsylvania area. And that is the hotbed of wrestling in America. George Washington was the first American to step foot in what they call the wilderness, which is the area of my backyard that I played in as a kid and hunted in and fished in. George Washington was a wrestler. He was the first white man to enter the wilderness. And after George Washington, there are a whole host of presidents, Ulysses S. Grant, Hoover, Harding, Garfield. Those are just some of the names that are associated with Ohio and American history and wrestling. And so I'm a part of the Ohio Wrestling Legacy, the Ohio Wrestling Hall of Fame, and a member of the national coaching staff. So I've allowed wrestling to give me an education and provide me with the tools that I needed as a teacher and as a coach. And I came from the hotbed of wrestling, Ohio, and the Ohio Valley. Now, Lou Holtz's museum is one of the showcase of sports history and memorabilia from the Ohio Valley, and it's athletes' history. So we're a part of a real powerful wrestling community. The American wrestling community is first and foremost in the annals of history as far as accomplishments. Lincoln, Washington, Jefferson, Roosevelt, Coolidge, those guys were all presidents that were wrestlers, and there are a lot more. So one of the things that we are trying desperately to do is to save wrestling in the Olympic Games, and that's one of the reasons why I'm so excited about your project. I think that we need to tell our story and tell it better. Not that I'm the one to tell it, but I've got part of the story. Mm-hmm. And saving wrestling now has become my greatest motivation.
Mm. So was wrestling your very first sport, or how did you first get into any kind of sports activity at all?
The first thing that I did as a youngster on the church playground, where all the kids gathered, we didn't have toys to play with, so we most of the time we were playing with each other, and wrestling was one of the things that we all did. The girls and the boys wrestled in the churchyards and on the school playgrounds. Wrestling, we were coal miner kids. We were steel mill kids. We were farmers and a very diverse community of Eastern Europeans, Africans, Native Americans. We were just a collective group of dynamic, hardworking people, coal miners and farmers, mill people. So we grew up wrestling every day, and there was usually more than one group of people at a time that you would be wrestling with. For example, we lived close to Barton, Ohio. We lived close to Lansing. We lived close to Bridgeport, Bel Air, and Wheeling, and Martins Ferry. Those were all the hotbeds of athletics, and that's the hodgepodge that I came out of. I started off as a baseball player, and I also played football. I wasn't big enough to play big-time football, but I was recruited heavily in football and baseball. So our community was an athletic community, and there was a lot of pride in what we were doing. Everybody wanted to be Olympic champion. That was the goal for most of the guys that I ran with that were involved in wrestling. And so my quest was to be the Olympic champion.
Mm-hmm. So tell me how you were first introduced to wrestling, where you had formal coaching.
Yeah, I was adopted by a man by the name of George Kovalik. He was my father in a sense. And he was my football coach, he was my baseball coach, and he was my wrestling coach. And I became like a part of his family, and we're still very close now as a family. And so because of George Kovalik, I wanted to become a school teacher. I admired and respected him for the way he treated people and the way he dealt with problems. And plus he was just he was a fierce competitor, and there was something about him that the type of guy that could lead you on the battlefield or lead you academically or however. He was a graduate from Kent State. He and Lou Holtz are both graduates from Kent State, and at that time Kent State was at the cutting edge of football. And out of that group of college graduates that my coach came through with, came some of your greatest American football coaches. And my high school coach, George Kovalik, was one of those great football coaches. He was also a great baseball coach, and he was also a great gymnastics coach, and he was also a great track and field coach. He taught all of those skills. At the same time, he was an unbelievable school teacher, and I wanted to be like him.
Hmm. So it sounds like he, you know, played a big part in, you know, your becoming a wrestler.
Absolutely. George Kovalik and my grandfather, and I don't know if people realized how difficult it was. I only weighed 88 pounds when I was a freshman in high school, and so I had to fight every day of my childhood life. Somebody wanted to fight me, because I was the smallest guy out there, and wrestling became my best friend. I could wrestle. I knew how to get a hold of the arms and get a hold of the neck and throw them down. I knew how to do those things instinctively because I had to do it every day. And so I became competitive, and the wrestling helped me so much as a football player and as a baseball player. And I like all kids, I was in love with baseball. I was in love with football during football season, but I only weighed 88 pounds when I was a freshman in high school, so I had problems with size, but I had great speed. And at that time, we didn't run the 40-yard dash. We ran 30-yard dashes, and I could do the 30-yard dash in about four flat. That was good, because that's all I needed. I wasn't one of the strong running backs And I was in a football culture, and I wasn't going to be a football player. So I used football to help me become a better wrestler. I used baseball to help me become a better football player. And I combined all those sports, plus having the type of coaches and teachers and being in the environment that I was in. It was very, very competitive, very competitive. It's just called the Ohio Valley Athletic Association. Good people came out of there. Good people, great people.
Well, Mr. Douglas, tell me about your journey to the Olympics.
In 1963, I was selected to wrestle for the American team in the World Championships in Greco-Roman. And during that time, I came in contact with the freestyle wrestlers, and I started learning freestyle wrestling. That was when I was a sophomore in college. And once I started learning freestyle, I made a team and went overseas, and I was successful in Greco-Roman, and I was successful in freestyle. And so my goal became I wanted to win the gold medal in the Olympics, but I didn't have anyone to train with, and I didn't know the rules, so I had to transfer to Oklahoma State in order to get the type of training that I needed. And I had choices. I had Oklahoma, Iowa State. I had Michigan. And I had Kent State also. Those were schools that were recruiting me, but I knew that I had to learn how to wrestle on my feet, and the only place I could find that type of training was at Oklahoma State. And so once I settled in at Oklahoma State, I had a lot of work to do, and I had a very short window to get it done in. I had like 6 months to get ready for the Olympic trials, and that meant I had to learn the rules in 6 months, and that was hard to do. And I had a Japanese roommate or teammate by the name of Yojiro Itaki Obata, who was trying to make the Japanese team, and we were training together. Hardest training I ever did in my life was with that guy. And as he got better, I got better. And our goal was to meet in Tokyo at the Olympic Games and celebrate after we won the gold medal. Well, he won the gold medal. I didn't. I took fourth. And I saw one of the greatest and most courageous matches I've ever seen. He had his shoulder torn out of socket in his first match and wrestled through the Olympic Games with a separated shoulder. And every match he had, they had to put the shoulder back in. And I never, ever saw any flinch of pain or anything. This guy was just a phenomenal guy. His name was Yojiro Itaki Obata. Probably the greatest of the Olympic champions, if not the greatest, has to be one of the greatest. But he was my training partner, and we trained for 6 months together. 6 months, he went back and made the team and wrestled for Japan. 6 months, I made the team and wrestled for America. So I achieved my goal in part and win the gold medal, but I was on my way, and I knew I could do it the next time.
Mm-hmm. Were there any differences between the 64 Olympic trials and the 68 Olympic trials?
There was a lot of difference. The rules kept changing. That was a big difference. The Olympic trials in 64 were in New York City at the World's Fair. That was very, very difficult because I didn't know the rules at the time. The rules internationally kept flip-flopping, so you never really knew the rules until you got to the tournament. And then technically, I had a lot of work to do technically. And what I knew I had a good plan on how to make the team. Winning the gold medal was my goal, and I wasn't sure about that because I didn't really know the rules, and I didn't know the technique that well either. So my focus was on, number one, making that team in 1964. Once I made that team, then my focus shifted to winning the gold medal. And, I just wasn't good enough to win at the time. I didn't have enough experience. In 68, I got injured in the first match and was out of the tournament. So I had kind of a tragic career in my quest for the gold.
Yeah. Well, going back to 64 and also thinking about 68, how would you also compare the opening ceremonies?
Well, in 64, the opening ceremonies in 64, I was so awestruck by what was going on. I really couldn't grasp or understand. I was caught up in the glory of the Olympic Games. I'd achieved a great goal, but I had one more goal to go, and it just seemed like it was a dream. And then in 68, it was more like a nightmare. In 68, there was so much politics going on. There was so much anger in the air. The civil rights movement was moving forward. There was tragedy and police brutality. There was demonstrations against the war. So there was a climate that was politically charged, and it was, I could never really focus on the mission. The other thing is, in 68, I did not realize how altitude would affect me. I thought if you trained in altitude and you went and wrestled in altitude, you were fine. That wasn't the case. We trained at altitude, and we didn't train properly because we didn't know how to train. When you wrestle at altitude, it's a total different experience than when you're wrestling at sea level. And you have to adjust to that altitude in order to get ready for the competitions. We didn't have a chance to do that. The politics was so thick. There was a boycott proposed, and those people drove me crazy. I could never sleep. I was always on the telephone, people calling me about the boycott. And so I was in total confusion at those games. And then we walked downtown in Mexico City to that square where we were out there, where there was still blood in the streets, where they had killed thousands of students in that square right before the opening ceremonies of the Olympic Games. And the other thing is, we had to take part in the opening ceremonies, which I told them I would rather stay and make weight. They forced me to take part in the opening ceremonies. So I had to put on my rubber suit in order to make weight, because I was missing a training session to go through the opening ceremonies. And I got so dehydrated, I could barely function. I wore a rubber suit underneath my parade uniform, and my pants were soaking wet. And the walk was, I don't know how long, we walked forever. It must have been a couple of miles we walked in that hot sun. And I never recovered from that. To make a long story short, that was a that was a nightmare experience, the 1968 Olympic Games, as far as from a competition point of view.
Yeah.
I was never ready for that. Psychologically, I was never ready for it. Physically, I'd gotten injured. So that was a bad experience. And I look back at 1968 and I think about how many lives were totally destroyed because of the politics of the boycott, and the civil rights movement was moving ahead full speed, and I think the war was a big issue. It wasn't a good time for a guy like me. And I'd gotten drafted. I think they were trying to put me in the Army at the time too.
Oh my.
But it wasn't a good experience for me. But the thing I remember most of all is when Jesse Owens asked us not to boycott. Mm-hmm. And I can remember the anger of the athletes. I can remember the politics. And I can also remember, I think the guy's name was Brundage or something. He got booed. He was the most arrogant of IOC people that I've ever been around. And I've been around some bad ones. He was top of the shelf. And Brundage threatened us that if we boycotted, he was going to take action against us. And he was just talking to all the black athletes and all the Americans. We were the only ones. And I'll tell you, they booed. They booed him. And they booed Jesse Owens, too. There were some angry athletes. And it wasn't just black athletes. It was white athletes. It was women. It was men. People were unhappy. And the civil rights movement had a lot to do with that. But the boycott was led, I think, by some guys from Yale. I can't remember their names. And it wasn't really, it started with the guys from Yale, and it started up in Colorado. Well, I was in Colorado, Alamosa, Colorado, when they first started contacting me. And once they started contacting me, they never stopped. And I look back at the 68 Olympics with a heavy heart. It destroyed so many, but it also opened a lot of doors. It opened the eyes of the world about athletics, athletes, and it opened the eyes of the black athletes. Education, I think, became a lot more important. I think that mentorship became a lot more important. Going back and helping rebuild your neighborhoods and helping give kids an opportunity to participate, that became important. That's what became important to me. I wanted to be a school teacher. I wanted very badly to, and I wanted to be a kindergarten teacher because I didn't want all the problems that went along with the upper, older kids. But I look at wrestling like the greatest thing that ever happened to me. It gave me an education.
Mm-hmm. So you were talking about your training and preparation for the Olympic Games. How big of a part was weight training in your preparation?
We didn't weight train as much as they do now, and we probably should have, but that wasn't part of our agenda. We were more of a wrestling conditioning team. Americans were not known for technique. We were known for conditioning. And so one of the things that we did is we trained harder than anyone in the world. Maybe the Japanese, perhaps the Japanese, and perhaps the Iranians. You know, it's hard for me to say, but I don't think anyone could have trained harder than we trained. We were training 6 hours a day. That's unheard of now. We trained for 6 hours a day, 6 days a week, and sometimes seven. That was the hardest training that I've ever gone through in my life. I was in shape for the next 4 years after I left Alamosa, Colorado from that Olympic training camp. Mm. I saw guys like Gable Cry, Wayne Wells. I've seen guys throw fits and leave the mat, fist fights. The type of training that we did is a probably only training that could be harder would be special forces type training. And a lot of the guys that are in wrestling go into those special forces and they have no trouble passing the test. But it was tough training. We overtrained and because we didn't know. We didn't use drugs, okay, and we didn't pay the officials off. And our officials couldn't be bought off. That was the difference between the American system and the rest of the world. The rest of the world, those guys were cheating. They were throwing matches. They were holding back on points. There was ways to win by not wrestling. And the officiating had a lot to do with it. The reason wrestling is in the situation it's in right now is because of John DuPont corrupted wrestling. John DuPont corrupted wrestling. Wrestling became a pawn for John DuPont, and wrestling sold out, gave John DuPont the key to the house of wrestling, and as a result of that, he murdered Dave Schultz, and he murdered wrestling. One of the big reasons wrestling's in the situation it's in right now is because of John DuPont. John DuPont and Raffi Martinetti, those guys, they corrupted wrestling. Raffi Martinetti threatening people on the IOC committee, acting like a gangster, a hoodlum, changing the rules so that the officials could control the matches and he could control the officials. That's why wrestling was thrown out of the Olympic Games, because of the corruption. My goal is that we educate the world about the value of wrestling, because wrestling helps with an educational piece that no other sport can bring. Mm. And so it's important for our kids. It's important that wrestling survive because it's the best friend that little people have. Wrestling's my best friend, believe me. Big people, they're somewhat secure in their size, but when you become a wrestler, you become secure. That's a great feeling. And that's what wrestling does for kids. It gives them confidence to do things that nobody else can do. So that's why wrestling is important for International Olympic Committee to look at this. It's not just for wrestlers. It's for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Wrestling's the oldest of all sports. So my goal is to somehow maybe get you to say this, what I'm saying, in such a way that it helps us save wrestling.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll certainly try to honor that as best we can. So Mr. Douglas, you mentioned your training methods and regimen compared to that of other countries. So it sounds like you were aware of how your competitors trained, no?
Yes, we were very aware of how they trained. The problem was they had a system, a development system that starts when they're in elementary school and progresses all the way through to the Olympic Games. The American wrestling system doesn't start with Olympic technique until the kids are out of high school. The rest of the time, and that's the only time they really get national attention, because most of the time the kids that are wrestling in high school, they only wrestle a few matches in the summertime in freestyle. Some of them go overboard, but the vast majority of them don't start wrestling freestyle, which is the Olympic style. They don't start that until they get to college.
Hmm.
Whereas the rest of the world starts when they're in elementary school. So we are way, way behind. What we need to do is, there is a formula called the Sunkiss Kids Formula. That is a curriculum that shows how to start young people at the appropriate age and walk them all the way through to the Olympic Games. We have that available. The problem is our kids wrestle freestyle or Olympic style wrestling only about 20% of their career. 80% of their career they wrestle collegiate style wrestling.
Hmm.
So that we're way behind, but we can catch up. We just need to tweak our rules a little bit, and we're doing that. The new generation of coaches realize that they know that we need to keep wrestling in the Olympic Games if we're going to keep wrestling alive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the missions, I think, now is, hey, we got to put a better product out there. And one of the things we need to do is we need to make it easier for people to understand how you score points, how you win and how you lose. And then we got to dress it up like they're doing with other sports, modern sports. We have to have professional people broadcasting the matches. We have to have some showmanship, like they do in football, basketball, baseball. They've got these little contests that they run. And then we've got to market it down to the elementary level. We got to bring the freestyle technique down, which I think we can do that. And we are going to do it. Everything that I'm saying we need to do, they will eventually do it. I have been preaching about some rule modifications that are now taking place.
Mm-hmm.
But it took me 20 years to get them to change.
Yeah.
The fact is, we can keep wrestling in the Olympics and we can grow it. It can take its rightful place because of its diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Wrestling is the most diverse sport of all the sports. There's no sport that's more diverse. This is where we failed. We have failed to market the value of wrestling to our culture. We are a race of wrestlers. Americans have always wrestled. It's always been a part of the festivals. From the beginning of time,
mm-hmm.
wrestling has always been a part of civilizations. The Mongolian civilizations, those are all wrestlers, all of them.
Hmm.
So, I mean, Iran as that's a nation of wrestling and wrestlers.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, Turkey's a nation of wrestlers. That's their national sport.
Oh, wow.
So, and a lot of people don't understand that. The first book that was ever written was written by a wrestler. The first book that was ever written was written by Homer. Homer was a blind poet and a wrestler. The first book that was ever written was written about wrestlers.
Hmm.
So, I mean, in the first, when you look in the pyramids, one of the first things you see when you go in the pyramids is wrestling. So there's a lot more to this wrestling than people realize.
Yeah. I mean, I was absolutely shocked when I heard they were considering removing it from the Olympic Games. I was very
Everybody was shocked, but if you understand, if you want a story, the story is, how did that possibly happen? I just told you how it happened.
Yes,
Martinetti and those guys that were in FILA, they threatened the people in the IOC. They threatened them. They wanted the IOC to do something, and the IOC said, no, we're not going to do it. So they kind of made a little threat against them. And so the next thing that happens is those people in the IOC get together, and they throw wrestling out.
I see.
They threw wrestling out of the Olympic Games. That's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the you could not be an Olympic champion unless you were a wrestler. That's how important wrestling was. There every Olympic champion from the beginning of time had to be a wrestler.
Hmm.
So that's how far back our history goes.
Yes, very.
So
very
when you think about this, wrestling's history is in the DNA of humanity, male and female. It's there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a valuable tool for kids. It provides them with a safety net. Wrestlers, those little kids that are wrestling right now, they're going to grow up and be much better people because of their wrestling experience.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the reasons why we have to make sure that wrestling survives in the Olympic Games. And now there are other reasons. There are other reasons for it. The culture of the world is turning brown. More Hispanics, more blacks, more mixed black and white marriages. So the world is turning browner and browner, and wrestling's a part of that culture. The kids that are coming in that are going to be coming through from the reservation, they're not going to be basketball players or baseball players or football players. Most of them are going to be wrestlers.
Hmm.
So that's why I think it's really important that the message, we got to save wrestling. We got to save wrestling in the Olympic Games, and this is my effort. I'm putting together a documentary, and I go through some of this. I'd like to use some of the material that you use. But my whole pitch is that we're not doing this because it's a sport. We're doing it because it's a necessary piece of culture. This sport is unique in what it does for kids. If it wasn't a unique sport, how the hell did seven presidents become, they were wrestlers?
Yeah,
the greatest general, the greatest two generals in history, and I don't know, Robert E. Lee has to be included in that group, but Grant and Washington, you don't get any higher than that. And Lincoln, and then you run through all Taft, Harding, Roosevelt. Those guys were all wrestlers. Coolidge. So when you start putting things like that together, you can see that wrestling's part of America's DNA. It's part of us. And it's always going to be a part of the Olympics unless we allow some rollerblade sport or some ball sport to remove us. And I'm not going to let that happen.
Mm-hmm. There's certainly a rich cultural heritage behind wrestling and its history with our country and the Olympic Games. Bobby, going back to your own experiences in 64 and 68, was there anyone on the team that was like your best friend, anyone on the wrestling team, or did you have a really good friend that was on the Olympic team but in another sport?
Well, Rick Sanders was my good friend. He got killed in a car accident. We were roommates. He was my good friend. Fred Lett, we trained together. He was another very good friend of mine. Yojiro Witake Obata, he was a training partner. Tadaki Hatta, Hatta, he was a training partner. We were all kind of had our focus on making the Olympic team, and we all trained together. I went from Oklahoma to Michigan to train.
Hmm. And Bobby, you mentioned the Olympic Project for Human Rights and the, I think it was the Harvard crew letter. getting a, maybe like a letter or being contacted by some people from Harvard or by some people that were working for the Olympic Project for Human Rights?
Yeah, that was, I think those guys were from Yale.
Okay.
I'm not sure. It was Harvard, or they may have been two different groups. Yeah, they contacted me several times while I was in training camp, and they wanted me to boycott the Olympic Games, and they wanted me to, I don't know, there was some kind of demonstration or something they wanted to put together,
mm-hmm.
and I told them I wasn't interested.
Yeah, that sounds, I mean, you said it was a stressful time. That certainly sounds like a very stressful time, and you had mentioned, like, seeing the aftermath of the Tlatelolco massacre, where the students in Mexico City were fired upon?
Yeah, I went down there. Rick Sanders and I went down to take a look at it. We heard about it, and a lot of the students were talking about it. We ran into some Mexican families, and we kind of hung out with them, and they were telling us about what had happened. The Army just opened fire on the students and killed a lot of people. And I guess this wasn't the first time that it happened. It was the first time that I'd read about it. But yeah, it was. You could tell that those troops, when we were doing our march to the stadium, the highway, both sides of the highway was lined with tanks for miles and miles. Tanks and armored military cars and soldiers. It looked like a soldier every 10 foot. And all the way into the stadium, there was an uneasy feeling. And when we got out on the field inside the stadium, it was well, there were thousands and thousands of people. And we got out on the parade ground, and we'd been standing in line for hours. Some of the people were passing out. Girls were falling out left and right. And we were out on the parade ground, and they turned those pigeons loose. And the pigeons had been pinned up for a long time. And so when the pigeons started flying around, they started crapping as they were flying. And you could see the people were putting papers over their head, and the athletes, as they came over the athletes were putting papers over their head, and the pigeons were bombing us. And they circled a couple of times, and every time they'd circle, you could hear the crowd roar as the pigeons came by. And that was one of the things that I remember. And the athletes were passing out left and right from standing so long and from that long march. But I remember going back to the stadium and watching the 400-meter relay where the Americans won. I remember that. And the long jump, I remember that. And my high school coach, George Kovalik, came to watch me compete. And he was with me during that time, and that made it a lot more memorable for me.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So did Kovalik also make it to the 64 Olympics in Tokyo?
No, he didn't make it to the 64 Olympics. He made it to the 68 Olympics, and shortly after that, he passed away, and I can't remember what the date was, but we were very close, very close.
So, Mr. Douglas, what were your impressions of Mexico City, and how would you compare Mexico City during the Olympics to Tokyo during the Olympics?
Well, Mexico City looked like a military base. There were just soldiers everywhere, and I didn't enjoy Mexico City. A lot of it had to do with cutting weight and what was going on with the civil rights and my training. And I had recently had a son who was born premature, and he was struggling. And so that was weighing heavily on my mind during the time that I was training. And he made it, but his life was in jeopardy for a long time. For the first 6 months of his life, he was in an incubator. So I was struggling with that, and also I was trying to make up my mind about a job offer. Campus Crusade for Christ had offered me a job, and Iowa State had offered me a job, and I knew if I went to Iowa State, I'd get a chance to train with Gable, and also I get a chance to get mentored by Dr. Harold Nichols. So there were some advantages, and I selected Iowa State, came to Iowa State and trained with Gable for the next 2 years. So, and he got great results. He and I go way back in our training. We trained together when we were younger. And then, of course, we competed against each other as coaches in college.
Hmm. What were your impressions of the security measures in Tokyo and then in Mexico?
Well, Tokyo, very well organized. The things were, that's probably the best way to describe Tokyo, very well organized. Things ran smoothly. In Mexico, not very well organized. There was a lot of problems with the transportation. At the last minute, there was big time problems with credentials. They just weren't as organized as they were in Japan. The other thing is that the cloud and the atmosphere in Mexico was heightened by the fact that there had been a slaughter in the streets, and there's a revolution going on. And at the same time, the Olympic Games are going on, and I could feel all that pressure. The civil rights movement was roaring. There were a lot of issues on the table. That war, the Vietnam War, was roaring, and I'd lost some very close friends in that war, including a brother. So I had a lot of mixed feelings about the politics, about the Olympic Games, about the organization. The wrestling organization was in turmoil. The American Wrestling Organization was absolutely in turmoil. There was a big fight, and the USA Wrestling wanted to go to South Africa and wrestle, and I was against that. And when I verbally came out and stated that I didn't think it was in the best interest of the American wrestling programs to go to South Africa because of apartheid. And then the people in USA Wrestling didn't like that. And I was the first athletes rep for the AAU. So as the athletes rep, I wrote them a letter telling them why I disagreed. And the letter was to my coach, who was the president of USA Wrestling at the time. And I told him I didn't agree with America going to wrestle in South Africa. That started the fight with me and USA Wrestling. So that fight eventually ended up USA Wrestling. The guy who, Myron Roderick, was my coach. So he and I sat down and talked, and I became the athletes rep for USA Wrestling also. So I was the first athletes rep for both organizations. And that's why I can speak like this. I've been around it longer than anyone, and I won't be muzzled because somebody doesn't like what I'm saying. And I've said this many times before. We could be the greatest wrestling country on the face of the earth if we made some rule changes. And I'm not saying make the change to freestyle or Olympic-style wrestling. I'm saying make some rule changes that facilitates our athletes' efforts. Once we do this, then we can assure that we're going to win medals, but more important, we're going to assure that wrestling will survive in the Olympic Games. When Americans start winning more medals, wrestling will survive.
Hmm. Mr. Douglas, what about the accommodations, the Olympic Village in Tokyo versus Mexico?
I have no complaints about Tokyo at all. Mm-hmm. Mexico, I have no complaints about Mexico. I didn't think that there was any problem, but you have to understand, I was on a diet most of the time, so I didn't partake in the food areas. And cafeteria food wasn't, after being dieting like we dieted, you wanted a steak or you want to get out and get something that's a little bit different than cafeteria food. But the food was great in both villages.
Hmm, good. What about the issue with food and waterborne illnesses that was an issue in Mexico City? Did you or anyone you know become ill in Mexico?
Everyone I knew became ill in Mexico, including me. That was one of the problems. I had a problem and got dehydrated and couldn't recover in time. But, it all has to do with hygiene, and the hygiene down there was ridiculous. We just it was poor sanitary conditions. I don't know of anybody on our team that didn't get nailed with Montezuma runs, and that was a problem.
So you already talked about feeling the effects of Vietnam and how much that weighed on your mind, and issues with the draft and friends who had been killed. Vietnam is associated with the Cold War, was part of the Cold War, and 68 was kind of a height for the Cold War. What effect, if any, did the Cold War have on the 68 games, and your team's interactions with Soviet bloc athletes?
Well, there was tremendous competition between the USSR, those 30 nations that are no longer under communist control. Those 30 nations made up one team called the USSR. They were a team of 30 different nations, some of the most powerful wrestling nations in the world. Then came the Iranians, then came the Americans, then came the Turks, but the Russians were way ahead, and they were doing all the things that you've read about. They were using the drugs. They were bribing officials. The only officials you couldn't bribe was the American officials and the American wrestlers. You couldn't bribe those guys, and I'm including myself in those guys. We wouldn't lay down for anyone. But what happened was we caught them cheating a couple of times and exposed them. And as a result of that, the officiating became very polarized. And you could just about tell whether or not you had a chance to win based on who was assigned to officiate your match. Well, the guy that was assigning people to officiate the matches was Raffi Martinetti, and he was cheating. And that element of corruption has been a part of freestyle wrestling. The big story here is that Dave Schultz, one of our wrestling treasures, was murdered because USA Wrestling allowed itself to be corrupted by John DuPont. The corruption was so great that they even allowed this John DuPont to be claimed a champion, a world champion of some sort. And the guy could barely put on a jock strap. But that's how corrupt we became. He gave him a lot of money to do this, and they allowed him. They allowed him to corrupt the program. He did the same thing with the swim team in Santa Clara. He did the same thing to the American wrestling program, and we're still trying to recover from that. Dave Schultz movie is going to come out. I don't know if you're familiar with Dave Schultz or not.
No.
Dave Schultz was one of our great wrestlers who was murdered by John DuPont. John DuPont's one of the wealthiest men in the world. John DuPont murdered Dave Schultz because, I'm not sure what all, but Dave was going to leave John DuPont's program and go to another program. It's a movie. It'll be played. If you see the movie, you understand part of what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
But here's where wrestling is in the world. Wrestling is in trouble because we allowed guys like John DuPont, Raffi Martinetti. Raffi Martinetti is the president of FILA for many years. He corrupted wrestling. And I pointed it out to him. I don't have a very good relationship with FILA, but I pointed this out to him. And so what they did, the Americans turned against me. The administration told me that they didn't want me to talk about this anymore. And I told them, hey, in no unpleasant terms, you could go stick your head up somebody's rear. But the fact that we allowed this to happen, we are now trying to recover. And it has gone so far as to even affect our position in the wrestling community. None of this means anything if wrestling leaves the Olympic Games. So my mission is to make sure that I do everything I can do to help wrestling survive and stay in the Olympic family. Diversity is the real key here. We have to market and show our diversity. We have to show that. Once the world sees our diversity and how it impacts kids around the world and communities around the world, we can survive. That's the only way we can survive. That's my opinion anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly wish you the best of luck in you know, your campaign to keep wrestling in the Olympics, and I hope that this helps in some way.
I'm sure your article, that with the job that you're going to do on this article, it's going to work.
Well, Mr. Douglas, I wanted to ask about testing for banned and performance enhancing substances. 68 games in particular are known as kind of the start of the first drug testing attempts and drug testing programs since instituted at the Olympic Games. What do you remember, especially since you were in 64 and 68, what do you remember about testing for banned and performance enhancing substances in 64 and 68?
I don't recall us testing for anything in 64 or 68, but I do recall wrestling a Russian who felt like Superman. In 1965, I wrestled that same Russian a couple years later, and he felt normal. I don't know whether he was doing drugs or what, but I never felt any strength like that. And I'd watched the guy. He was a world medalist. He wasn't a world champion. But I know that there was something different. And also, I trained with guys, and I felt them at certain times. They were a lot more powerful. So there was something to the drugs. I know they worked. I never dabbled in those drugs other than sleeping pills when I was cutting weight. But I know they work. I know they work, and I know I've seen unbelievable performances out of guys that I just didn't think were capable of doing some of the things that they did. And then the next time you see them, they wrestled normally. So yeah, we didn't do a lot of testing during my time.
So you already talked a little bit about the assassination of Dr. King and 68 being a really pivotal time for the American Civil Rights Movement. Going back to the Smith and Carlos protest on the medal stand during the 68 games, were you there in the stadium? Did you witness the protest?
You know what? I'm not sure I witnessed the protest. I think I was there, but I don't think I realized what was going on at the time. I think I was there. We took some pictures, and we have the pictures of them on the stand. My high school coach was there, and he took some film of those guys on the stand. But I don't know if he got that or not.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a buzz. It went through the village like a wildfire.
Mm-hmm.
Every athlete was talking about it. I heard about it on my way back from a training session, and it was a talk. And they were sending them home, and they were going to do this, and there was just a mess. The media was all over it, and it was like a feeding frenzy.
And what were your personal thoughts and feelings at the time?
I had a number of thoughts. Number one, even though that wasn't the place to do what they did to make the protest, I understood why they did it. And it's like, I think it took a lot of courage to do what they did. And I think that they knew that they were going to pay a big price for it. But I think that they were motivated by something a little different than what the norm was at the time. Not very many athletes would have done what they did. They had an opportunity to make a statement, and they made a statement. Like it or not, they did it.
Mm-hmm. Well, looking back, what do you think of the USOC's and the IOC's response at the time?
Well, you had a racist at the top of the IOC. Brundage,
mm-hmm.
he personifies racism. Okay, so automatically, that leaves me with a negative feeling toward him. How he tried to deal with the problem, it was almost like the slave owner mentality and the South African attitude and the KKK attitude and the white supremacist attitude. It was like all those things were felt a little bit like this guy might be a Nazi. But I've had all those wonders about him, and his mannerisms just told me this guy's just a pure, outright racist. He gives a damn about nobody but himself and his clique.
Hmm.
That was my feeling. And the IOC, he had obviously had enough stuff on them that he could control the people that were going to be voting, and he did.
Hmm. So you mentioned there being a media frenzy. Do you have any other memories or distinct impressions about the media from your experiences in the Tokyo and Mexico City Olympic Games?
Well, track and field was the main show, and the media frenzy was around the track and field people. At every Olympics that I've been to, that's the way it's been. And if anything happened in the track, people were involved, there was going to be a lot of media coverage. Wrestling and other sports were like almost like a sideshow. And obviously, the shoe people and the companies and different organizations that were marketing these athletes, they were going to make sure that they got their share of the publicity. And the media goes after the ball sports and goes after sports that has equipment, because I think that those sports lobby the media, and they grease them a little bit here and there. So sports like wrestling only has a few shoe companies and a couple of headgear companies and some garment companies. That's not enough to make a huge impact on the media, so we don't get that type of coverage. But we get stars every now and then: Jordan Burroughs, Kale Sanderson, Jake Varner. We get those type of guys every once in a while, and they can help stimulate. Dan Gable's name's still hot. He keeps John Smith's name's still hot. He keeps stimulating, and these stars of the future keep filtering up. And MMA has also given us another avenue for developing our folk style wrestling or freestyle wrestling or international wrestling. But we have to understand that if we're going to market wrestling, we have to market it from an educational point of view. We can't compete with these other ball sports and sports like your equipment types, hockey sports, sports that has a lot of equipment. We can't do that.
Mm-hmm. For you personally, what was the most memorable part of being an Olympian?
I think when we took the oath, the Olympic oath, I felt something real special, that I had a chance to be a part of history, and that I had a chance to do something that could really, really impact a lot of kids like me, and I had a chance to do something that would really, really make my country proud of me.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to do something that would really give me a feeling of being a part of something special. And I fell in love with mythology at a very young age. And I was reading about the Olympians when I was in kindergarten. And for some reason, that it had a special ring for me. And I, at a very young age, I thought about being an Olympic champion. I don't know, and I didn't even know about wrestling. All I knew is that Jesse Owens was a star in my book, and he was an Olympic champion, and I wanted to be an Olympic champion.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like Jesse Owens was a hero of yours growing up. Did you have any other kind of larger than life heroes that you sought to imitate as you were growing up?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I really. I can't really say that there was any one person.
Mm-hmm.
That. Well, my high school coach, but that was, I didn't meet him until I was in high school. I was 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, I was raised by a grandmother. I wasn't raised around men. The men that I was raised around were coal miners and people that were neighbors. So I never really locked on to any one figure. Mm-hmm. I was more or less trying to figure it out as I went along.
Yeah.
I knew one thing that I wanted to, at a very young age, I wanted to be a school teacher. I like, because I think a lot of it had to do with the kindness that some of my teachers showed me.
Hmm. And Mr. Douglas, were you there in 68 for the closing ceremony?
I was there for the closing ceremonies. I was there for the opening and the closing. I can't remember the closing ceremonies, but I was there.
Hmm. What was your homecoming or reception like when you returned to the United States? What happened?
Well, I was injured, so I had a hard trip coming back. I was suffering from separated rib cartilages, and I was kind of brokenhearted too. And also, I was under a lot of stress. My son was he was still in the hospital. He had been in the hospital for about 30 or 40 days. And so I was coming home to some stressful situations.
Mm-hmm.
I can't go back and visualize or emotionally think of what I was going through. We were struggling because I had taken all the money that we'd saved and used it to train for the Olympic team for that year. So we were struggling, and I was trying to find a job. So I had some work to do when I got home. I needed to find a job. I needed to wrap up a master's degree. I needed to wrap up my master's degree, and I needed to find a job. And that's what I set out to do. I was with Athletes in Action. Then I went to with Iowa State University, and then from Iowa State University, I went to Cornell University, and then from Cornell University, I went to. Where did I go? Cornell, back to Iowa State University, and then from Iowa State University to the University of California at Santa Barbara, and from Santa Barbara to Arizona State, Arizona State to Iowa State, and Iowa State, I'm still here.
Well, it sounds like you've had quite a career.
Yeah, it's been an enjoyable adventure. I've met some unbelievable people, and I've had some unbelievable students that... very proud of, and made some lifetime friends, coaching friends, and family friends. So, yeah, it's been an interesting journey. But if there's something that has to be echoed, we have to save this sport, and America deserves better. We can't allow this piece of our heritage to be stripped from the Olympic Games. We can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
We've got much invested in. America has wrestling in its DNA. That's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
Our greatest leaders have been from the wrestling community. We have had more from the wrestling community than any other organization that there is. And if wrestling and America, or I should say, if America's wrestling program is going to survive, it's going to be because I'm able to convince people such as yourself about the value of the sport. And we haven't done a very good job of that. I'm the first one to tell you we have done a very, very poor job of marketing and creating and reinventing wrestling. Some of our rules should have been gone a long time ago. We haven't had enough foresight to see the impact on this, because that's just the nature of the wrestling community's mind. Right or wrong, that's the way it is, and it's up to people like myself and hopefully someone like you that could get their attention by what you write.
Mm-hmm.
This is America could be the greatest wrestling country in the world. We could. We know that. We know how to do it. We've done it before. But our rules won't allow us to do that now. Our rules will not allow us to dominate the wrestling world. Now, I ask this question. How important, maybe it's not that important for us to send that message. Maybe it's not that important for us to be the dominant wrestling country in the world, but I think it is. I think it's important that we let our kids really have an equal opportunity with the rest of the world. I'm not asking for them to give us anything. I'm just saying, hey, America, let's take advantage of this. We can prove to you. We can prove that our kids are the best in the world.
I mean, I think it's a great, great message. I think that, you know, you're doing a good job at marketing the sport just in this interview.
I'm pretty passionate about it because you know who's joining our ranks more than any other group? Women. Our sport's growing because of women.
Awesome.
Women are getting involved in wrestling. We've got some really, really good young wrestlers coming up. But even as good as they are, they're going to have a very, very difficult chance of beating an Iranian, a Russian, a Korean. They're going to have a hard time beating them because they don't get to learn the rules until late. Now, if as a mother, I'm talking to you, and I don't think you're a mother yet, maybe you are, but as a mother, if I told you, hey, I'm going to give your son a shield that's going to take him through life, your son's going to have this shield that's going to guard him and help him make all the right decisions. I'm going to put your son around good people. I'm going to give him a chance to get an education. You tell me I couldn't talk you into letting your son become a part of this organization? You couldn't stand in front of me if you were a mother. I would convince you that this is, and your son, he's going to make the decision. He's either going to like it or he's not going to like it. But give him a chance to do that. That's all I'm asking. Give us a chance to prove the value of wrestling. We've already proven it. We were in the first books. We were on the first battlefield. We have America's back because we are a major part of your special forces. That's what wrestlers do. They're fighters. Now, you tell me that as a mother, I can convince you that this is a good activity for your son or your daughter to get into?
I mean, I think it sounds like a great activity. I want to get into it right now.
That's my job. That's are you an athlete?
A little bit.
Well, but that's my job. If I could get you to get involved in this, and you don't, the thing of it is, it's what it's going to do for you as a person. It's going to put you around good people. It's going to put you, it's going to make you work. You're going to work harder than you ever thought you could work because you're going to want to do some of these things so bad. And it's also going to motivate you to do other things in your life. That's what wrestling really does. And I mean, I'd like to see these guys win medals and win all these honors. But the fact that they're out there wrestling, that's the benefit. Mm-hmm. It's not what you win or you lose. Now, you're telling me that I couldn't sell you on becoming a wrestler?
No, I think you could definitely sell me on becoming a wrestler. I want to start wrestling right now. It sounds like...
Well, that's what you need to tell your people that are going to hear this. Yes, this is good for America.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just good for boys and girls. It's good for America. It's good for everybody.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Douglas, I wanted to ask you about amateurism and the role of amateurism and the rules of amateurism as they played out in your own career in wrestling, and also if how you would compare, you know, amateurism as it is today to what it was in 68.
In 68, the only athletes that were making any money were the track guys, and I think the swimmers were getting a little bit of sponsorship money, but nobody was getting any money. Most of the athletes were training on their own and training out of their pockets. The athletes from the foreign countries were being subsidized. The winter sports is a great example. Those winter sports, and the Americans did outstanding jobs in the winter sports, but you could see those governments were sponsoring the athletes from those European countries where the American athletes were being sponsored by the family or by maybe an equipment company here and there. And then now what they have is there's mass sponsorship of these programs. And the equipment people are your huge sponsors of your winter sports. And they do an outstanding job, and they pay their athletes well. Wrestling is now just getting to the point where we're paying our athletes to compete. So that's whereas the rest of the world has been paying their athletes since the beginning of time, America, we're just now catching up.
Mm. So, Mr. Douglas, what impact has being an Olympian had on your life? Like, do you think that there have been any special advantages because you are an Olympian, or have there been disadvantages from being an Olympian?
I can't see any disadvantages in being an Olympian, so we'll just scratch that one off. The advantage has been, from a coaching perspective, I've had an opportunity to be involved at every level of coaching. And from a competition level, I've had the opportunity to train with the best kids at all age levels. So I've had a chance to really study their growth and their ability to comprehend. I've also kind of connected everything with the old curriculum that I used when I first started coaching, which is the same curriculum that was used by Gallagher and Griffin at Oklahoma State. And I used that outline to do all my teaching. And what I'm trying to do now is get everything down as part of a curriculum so that I can direct you electronically on where to go and look at the question that you might have about wrestling. The same thing applies with history. I want to be able to direct you so that you could go anywhere electronically and look at this wrestling history. And then I think it's really important that we kind of try to get to these kids at a young age and get them involved in gymnastics and in activities that are not competitive, but will introduce them to wrestling activities by way of games and educating the community at the same time. And I think the other thing we need to do is we need to take our wrestling model, the Sunkist model, and we need to establish it around the country. They have regional training sites, which are, in fact, pretty close to the Sunkist model. But I think that the Sunkist model, along with what's growing now in the wrestling community with the Save Wrestling programs, I think we can put together a program that would introduce wrestling at the elementary level, and hopefully it would introduce the Olympic techniques at a younger level. And I think that's the only thing that we're missing as far as our development program.
What part do play and creativity have in wrestling?
Say that again.
What part do you see play and creativity playing in wrestling?
Well, in introducing the sport at a young level, at the kindergarten level or elementary level, I think it's always wise to introduce it by games of play games and animal games and gymnastics. And that way you can get an idea of the kid's coordination and his strengths and weaknesses and his level of speed. And also, I don't like to have a lot of competition at a young age. Rather than giving them trophies and having them wrestle in all these tournaments when they're real young, get them involved in activities, running activities, gymnastics activities, and a little bit of combative activities. But when you start them off real young, you lose an awful lot of them. And kids get the impression that you're only interested in them if they're a champion. But champion comes out much, much later.
Mr. Douglas, what one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
Well, I think you have to start training properly and at the proper age. In other words, if your goal is to be Olympic champion, you got to start doing some of the things that's going to help you become Olympic champion. I would say that you want to be active in more than one sport. I wouldn't just be a wrestler. I'd be baseball, soccer, basketball, whatever. Basketball and wrestling don't go that well together. But I would go for some other sports. Soccer's a great, great game. I'd have them involved in multi-sports. And then I wouldn't have them doing a lot of competition. I don't think you need to have 20 or 30 matches. Three or four matches a year at the elementary level, that's plenty as far as I'm concerned. You're not there to win matches. You're there to learn the technique and the training part of it. Mm-hmm. And then as you get into junior high, Yeah, probably a few more matches. I don't think that a kid should have more than 12 or 13 matches when he gets out of elementary school, gets into junior high. Then when he gets to high school, I think you can up the number of matches. And I think that you should mix it up and have not just one style of wrestling. If they're going to have high school rules, use high school rules, but you also integrate freestyle into the high school rules and Greco-Roman so that they're getting a much broader background.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Douglas, is there anything else you would like to tell us about before we close the interview?
Well, I don't know if I have anything just to tell you about. My hope is that somehow we can manage to save wrestling in the Olympic Games. Wrestling is the oldest sport, and Americans' wrestling heritage is very, very unique. Having been a wrestler most of my life, being involved in wrestling, I not only know the benefits and have experienced the benefits, I know that this is something that America needs, and I think that if America is going to survive and remain a power in the world, then wrestlers and wrestling is going to play a role in that. Mm-hmm. We have the greatest system on earth, and wrestling and wrestlers are one of the reasons for that.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to me today, and thank you for being generous with your memories as well.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I hope you have success.